Brother, it's our privilege to listen to Brother Tom Ruggiero this morning, and it is, of course, that Sunday each year that we listen to an election discourse, and it's only proper that we do so, that we think about all of the necessary items of what qualifies one to speak to us from the platform, and to have that picture of one who we would want to hear our Lord's truths. And so now, Brother Tom, we'll turn the podium over to him as he tells us of Portrait of a Servant. His title is Portrait of a Servant. Brother Tom.
Thank you, Brother Joe. Good morning, brethren. I have to tell you, it's been so long since I have given a talk without using PowerPoint that I feel kind of funny up here. That you should maybe look at the wall. I'll feel more natural. But I appreciate your patience. You know, one of the great principles that we understand to be at the very foundation of the divine plan is that God is striving to develop a society that wants to serve him out of the abundance of their heart. And his goal is to end up with a world that willingly serves him and one another. And so God is in the process of planting something within the heart of mankind that will drive them to serve willingly and joyfully and out of heart abundance. And of course, that driving force that he's planting in man over this long span of time is gratitude and love for one another and for him. He wants mankind to love him and to love one another so much that service to them will be as natural as breathing or eating. And he wants them to be so positively motivated to love and good works that in some ways it'll hurt when they don't have the chance to serve one another. You think about that in the world that we live in today. Can you picture a world that will have that kind of heart motivation for one another? How different it's going to be. For a race who will finally become one family, loving all nationalities, all men are brothers, a world that will be devoted to God in the principles that he's given to us and in the character that he displays, a race of man that will be united under Christ, who truly appreciates the sacrifice that was made for them, in a world that will be dedicated to the righteous principles of God and for the welfare of their fellow man. And so if I had to summarize the goal of the divine plan of the ages, that would be it. That God is striving to create a race that's devoted to God, united under Christ, dedicated to righteous principles and to the welfare of their fellow men. And of course, that goal has made the experience with sin and death absolutely necessary in the educational process of man. And we know that God could have chosen an easier way. And you know, when we witness about the permission of evil, we always say that God could have created a world of robots, programmed to follow all the rules and do everything that was right. But we know that that approach has a fatal flaw to it that would have marred God's creation and ruined it. And the fatal flaw is that a universe of robots, service and obedience given out of compulsion or programming is always weak and undevoted, and it lacks that crucial element of love that binds the hearts of his creation together. It's not the highest way to live. It's not God-like living. God's choice, God's higher wisdom, was to make an intelligent creator in his own image. And that means that all service must come out of abundant hearts filled with love and appreciation. That's the image of God. And anything else would have been an inferior creation. That's God's goal for the world. That's the primary work of the kingdom. And that's what God is going to accomplish in a world that today doesn't really appreciate those things, that really doesn't want God as part of their life, that would rather try to find their own way and create success for themselves. The world still has a lot to learn. They're only at the beginning stages of the educational process. Someday they're going to see the grandeur of God's method, and we know that most of them will accept it wholeheartedly. But the question is, what about you and me? What about those of us who have seen the goodness of God and want to cooperate with his plan and become what he wants us to become? Where do we fit into God's goal of serving out of heart abundance and appreciation? And of course, I know you know the answer to that question. By our consecrations, we've already said that God's goal is our goal, that whatever God wants, we want. We've told him that we're on board with whatever he is doing. And so the work for you and me starts much earlier than for the world of mankind. But it's so much more difficult to have a willing heart abundance when all society around us is so different. We're swimming upstream, as they say, in a world that hasn't gotten that message yet. And so if we're not careful, we can be affected by the selfishness and self-centeredness that's so prevalent in the world and bring it into our own lives and learn and not learn to be the servants that God is looking for. Brethren, as we examine the portrait of a true servant, the spirit of willingness is one of the first qualities we see illustrated in the scriptures. For example, in Exodus, the 35th chapter, we read about the time when God gave the instructions for building the tabernacle. And he makes it very clear that the free will of the people of Israel was essential even for the construction of the tabernacle. Let's turn to that chapter and begin reading at verse 4. This is Exodus 35, 4. It says, "And Moses spake unto all the congregation of the children of Israel, saying, This is the thing which the Lord commanded, saying, Take ye from among you an offering unto the Lord. Whosoever is of a willing heart, let him bring it an offering of the Lord, gold and silver and brass and blue and purple and scarlet and fine linen and goat's hair." And then all the way through verse 19, Moses enumerates all the items needed for the building and operation of the tabernacle. And then in verse 21, we see how the Israelites reacted to that. Verse 21 says, "And they came every one whose heart stirred him up, and every one whom his spirit made willing, and they brought the Lord's offering to the work of the tabernacle of the congregation for all his service and for the holy garments. And they came both men and women, as many as were willing-hearted." Then verse 29, "The children of Israel brought a willing offering unto the Lord, every man and woman whose heart made them willing to bring for all manner of work, which the Lord had commanded to be made by the hand of Moses." Now, you think about how the tabernacle was constructed. We realize that the Lord could have done all these things for them. He could have given them the gold and the silver and all the precious material that were used to build the tabernacle and all the clothing. He could have given everything that they needed to do the work. In fact, God could have built the tabernacle himself for them and told them, "Now this place that I've built is where you and I are going to commune together." But he didn't do that. He had the Israelites participate by offering their own possessions to make the tabernacle. And the point that God wanted Israel to understand that sometimes it costs something to truly worship God. What do you think would have happened to the whole process had the people said, "Well, you know, you're asking a lot, Lord. I've got this gold that I'd really like to keep for myself. Or I've got this beautiful white linen that I got from the Egyptians, and I was hoping to save it for my daughter's wedding. Do you really need it for the tabernacle?" You know, had they had that attitude, that spirit of not being willing and open to offer, the tabernacle would never have been built. And I think back on the Israelites and think, well, what was their motivation? Why were they so willing to offer? And I think that probably most of them who were so willing thought back to the Exodus, when God delivered Israel from bondage, and that it was really God's plagues on Egypt that produced all these wonderful things. They were slaves. How could they have gold or silver or brass or all these precious garments? They didn't have any of those things. But you remember, as they were leaving Egypt, the Egyptians poured all these gifts on them, probably hoping to get rid of them as fast as possible and get rid of the plagues. But it really was God's doing that gave them all the things that they later willingly donated to the tabernacle. And I think the ones who discerned that point, that it was really God's goodness that gave them all materials, were more willing and able to give of the things that they gave. And so we see that it's not only when we realize that we really don't have anything of our own, it's when we realize that we personally don't really have anything of our own of value to offer that we find it easier to give to the Lord's cause. Because none of us really has anything of our own brilliance. Everything we have is to the credit of the Lord. Without that spirit, we know the tabernacle would never have been built. and the opportunities of bringing offerings and sacrifices to the tabernacle probably would not have been possible. And even the Atonement Day sacrifices probably would have never happened if the willingness of the people wasn't at the foundation of the building. And I don't think they probably could have imagined what they would have lost without the tabernacle and the priesthood operating, but their willing heart made the construction possible. And so we see time and time again that where there's a willing heart amongst the Lord's people, the Lord brings abundant blessings into their lives. Now, after all the building material was brought by the people, there was another step that the Lord took. It's found in Exodus, the 35th chapter, verses 30 through 35. We're told that the Lord chose Bezalel, and he gave him skills to use all the material in constructing the tabernacle and its furnishings. Let me just read verse 31, talking about God to Bezalel. It says, "And he hath filled him with the Spirit of God, in wisdom, in understanding, and in knowledge, and in all manner of workmanship." And it goes on to say that Bezalel was given the ability to work in gold and silver and brass. He was given the gift of stone cutting and setting the stones in place, and also of wood carving. And one more thing he was given, which I thought was really interesting. He was given the ability to teach those skills to other people. And then he was also given another craftsman by the name of Aholiab, who was also given the skills of engraving and embroidering. But notice that the willingness came first, and then the Lord gave the ability to use what was given. That's really an important lesson for those of us who have been nominated to be class servants. You know, I think when we're maybe first nominated for an office or a job, we might say something like, "I don't know if I can handle that job. I don't know if I have the ability to be an elder or a deacon or serve on a committee." And of course, when there's particular talent involved, we really think that way, especially when we think about having the ability to teach. But notice that the Lord made up what Bezalel was lacking, even in the ability to teach. So, brethren, don't underestimate what the Lord can do through you. The Lord, over time and with practice, can help you gain the skills you'll need to serve. And when you think of the privilege of serving, you realize what an honor it is to be used by the Lord to be his spokesman. It's an honor for you to be used that way, but it's also an honor to God that he could take someone whose chief skill was a willing heart and supply what was lacking. Another lesson that came to mind when I read this was for those who have been elders and deacons for many years. You know, we have the opportunity of proving the old saying wrong. And the old saying is, you can't teach old dogs new tricks. I'm sure you've all heard that. I think that elders should never stop trying to improve their teaching skills. For example, if you see an elder from out of town come here, and he does something unique and that really reaches the brethren and touches them, it's good that we look at that and recognize and say, now what can I learn as a teacher from the brother who just did something really unique and was influential with the brethren? And see if I, as an elder, can gain that same skill to convey truth concepts that maybe I wasn't able to convey before. Or as elders, if we evaluate our study leading techniques and we see, you know, I tend to talk too much in a study. Or maybe I don't talk enough. Maybe I need to comment more. Or maybe we're hearing from the brethren that our talks aren't very clear, that the points we're making are not really being conveyed to the brethren properly. I think all of these things can be improved if we continue to evaluate our teaching methods and see if we're being a blessing to the brethren in the way that we're conveying the truth. Another example of the importance of a willing heart can be found in some of the last words that David ever spoke. In 1 Chronicles, the 28th chapter, this was near the end of David's life, and the Lord told him that it was time to install Solomon as the next king of Israel. And in verses 6 through 10, he gives his dying counsel to his son Solomon. Now think about that for a moment. If you knew that your life was nearing an end, and you wanted to give your son and daughter one last bit of advice, one last admonition, what would you say? This is what David said to Solomon. First Chronicles 28:9. He says, "And thou, Solomon, my son, know thou the God of thy father, and serve him with a perfect heart and a willing mind. For the Lord searcheth all hearts, and understandeth all the imaginations of the thoughts. If thou seek him, he will be found of thee. But if thou forsake him, he will cast thee off forever." The thought there of having a perfect heart is to have a complete heart, to have an undivided loyalty. With that undivided loyalty, he was admonished by David to also have a willing mind. These are the dying words of David to Solomon. Have an undivided loyalty and a willing mind. And that's a quality that God saw in the young Solomon. Qualities that he really didn't see in the other sons of David. And so he knew that because Solomon had these qualities, he was more able to reign over Israel. And when you think of that, what a privilege it was for Solomon to be the king over God's chosen people, because he had these essential qualities of being open-minded, to be, undivided in his loyalty to God, and have a willing spirit to do whatever God wanted him to do as king. And it was also a privilege for Solomon to build the temple. It was the dream of his father David that there should be a permanent temple for God. But God didn't let David do it, and so Solomon had that incredible privilege. We see a similar picture in the constructing of the temple that we saw in the building of the tabernacle. In 1 Chronicles 29, 5 and 6, we see that when it was time to start building the temple, no one was constrained to serve. At the end of verse 5, it says, "Who then is willing to consecrate his service this day unto the Lord?" Then the chief of the fathers and princes of the tribes of Israel, and the captains of thousands and of hundreds with the rulers of the king's work, offered willingly and gave for the service of the house of God. And then skipping down to verse 9, "Then the people rejoiced for that they offered willingly, because with perfect heart they offered willingly to the Lord, and David the king rejoiced with great joy." You see a recurring theme in there? Offered willingly, offered willingly, offered willingly. That is what the people's reaction were. And their reaction really wasn't a reflection of David's example. And of course, we know that David is a picture of Christ and the Gospel Age Church. And so here we see a lesson of how the willing sacrifices of the Gospel Age David class is going to inspire the world to give and to share and to work for the glory of God. Brethren, I think that someday mankind is going to look back at the Gospel Age and see the willingness of a David. Imagine the world looking back on us and seeing our business meetings, or how we conduct our ecclesia, or how we conduct our personal lives. That's the lesson here, that the example of David's willingness was conveyed to the people, and they rejoiced just like David did. Now, we shouldn't leave this account in Chronicles until we read at least part of David's beautiful heartfelt prayer. It begins in 1 Chronicles 29:14. It says, "But who am I, and what is my people, that we should be able to offer so willingly after this sort? For all things come of thee. Out of thine own have we given thee." And then skipping to the middle of verse 17. "As for me, in the uprightness of my heart, I have willingly offered all these things. And now I have seen with joy thy people, which are present here to offer willingly unto thee." Well, this is very similar to what we saw with the Israelites after the Exodus, wasn't it? That David here realized that everything he had was really from God. And so to offer it back to God was an honor and a privilege for him. So there's a recurring theme that we see repeated in the heart of David. Brethren, the same thing pertains to us. Who are we that God would accept our gifts and our offerings? Out of the good leadership of David, we see an entire nation bow before God. And we see David absolutely thrilled when he sees that. You think, what a gift that Israel gave to David in his old age. There is nothing else that they could have done that would have been a greater blessing to David than seeing their own willingness. And that's what we're looking for too, isn't it? We hope that someday the Lord will, the world will look back on our example of joyful service and be inspired to do the same thing and have the same heart. I guess it's almost hard to imagine how our ecclesia elections are going to be an example to the world in the kingdom, or even how our own personal service will be an example, how anyone's going to even know anything that we did. But if you imagine your service in that context, that someday people are going to be studying your life and seeing the willingness of your heart and the purity of your devotion, it might be easier to be more willing and more enthused with your personal sacrifice. So don't ever think that your service goes unnoticed. Don't ever feel unappreciated for the things you do, because in your service, you are creating a lesson for the eternal ages and for the blessing of every creature, no matter how small you might think your service is. Well, let me shift gears a little bit. When you were very young, maybe you were asked the question, what do you want to be when you grow up? Do you remember ever being asked that question? And if you were, do you remember how you answered it? Well, when our son Zach was maybe 5 or 6, we asked him that question. Thought for a minute, and then he puts up his arms. He says, I want to be a worker. I thought, a worker? What an unusual answer. What does he really mean by that? But then we have this adorable picture of him when his preschool class visited the Roselle Fire Station. And in that picture, he's wearing his adult fireman's coat that's twice as long as he is, that's kind of straddling the ground. And he's wearing this fireman's helmet that almost covers his whole face. But the part of his face you can't see, you see he's got this real determined look, like he means business. He's going to be putting out fires any minute now. And then sitting next to that picture, we have a more recent one of him as an adult, wearing a volunteer fireman's T-shirt from the department that he volunteers at up in Wisconsin. It's kind of like a before and after scene. So he sort of had an idea of what he wanted to be when he was young. I don't know why I told you that, but now think for a moment, what if we ask Jesus, Lord, what do you want me to be when I grow up? How do you think he would have answered that? Well, you know, he did answer that question for us. In essence, he says, I want you to be servants. Servants. Can you imagine any 5-year-old saying that when I grow up, I want to be a servant? I can't. It sounds a little demeaning, sounds a little humbling, maybe even a little undignified. The normal human desire when looking to a future career is, well, what's going to be the most fulfilling for me? What's going to be the most fun? Or even, how can I make the most money and have the most things in life? And so usually when you think about a future career is, what can I get out of it? But Jesus answers that a mature Christian's goal should be, what can I give? How can I serve? That's the ideal he shared for his true followers. Jesus said it of himself in Matthew 20:28. He said, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. Jesus came to serve. He came to teach how to serve. He came to show us how to serve. He taught us what the right motivation for God-like service should be. Now, that last point regarding the right motivation to serve, I had the opportunity of being at the Huntsville Convention this year, and the theme discourse was given by Brother Steve Yike, and the theme text was John 13:34-35. Let me read that for you. I'm sure you can quote this in your sleep. Jesus said, a new commandment I give unto you, that ye love one another as I have loved you, that ye also love one another. By this shall all men know that ye are my disciples, if ye have love one to another. And I'd like to share some of the thoughts that Brother Steve presented, because when I heard the talk, I immediately thought of how well the concepts fit into an election discourse and the portrait of a true servant. And I hope this isn't plagiarism. I actually asked Brother Steve for his notes, and I told him what I wanted to do with them, and I said, you know, next time you come to Chicago, feel completely free to give this talk, because I'm sure no one's going to remember anything I said. But even if they do, these principles are so important that we need to hear them often. Well, Brother Steve discussed how the scriptures use filio and agape love to distinguish different levels of motivation. I know you all know this. We've studied filio and agape love for many years. But it's good to see how they apply in practical ways and how they should be a motivation to our service. As you know, filio is family affection. It's brotherly love. even God has filial love. John 16:27 says, "For the Father himself loveth you." God filios you. He has a family affection for you. Now let me just read some of the thoughts from Brother Steve's talk. He said, "Filial love is good, and in God it's perfect. However, in fallen man, filio can degenerate. The definition for filio describes affection and attachment, and it focuses on the outward and the natural. And these lend themselves to thoughts of reciprocation, loving in order to receive love back. Now, that's not sinful. But carried further, filial love is motivated usually by looking for something in return. In other words, it's love with strings attached. And then carried one step further, filial love can become self-centered and even wrong. Notice some scriptures using filio and the varying degrees of self that come into the picture. For example, Matthew 10:37, "He that loveth filio, father or mother, more than me is not worthy of me. And he that loveth filio, son or daughter, more than me is not worthy of me." Luke 20:46, "Beware of the scribes who desire to walk in long robes and love filio, love greetings in the markets and the highest seats in the synagogues and the chief rooms at feasts." And then Brother Steve's conclusion about filio. He says, "Filio is noble and it's necessary, even godlike. But alone as a motivation for love in fallen human beings, it will tend to selfishness. Reciprocation of love is not evil either. We need the love and affection of others. But if this is the primary motivation for love, we will come up short of God's standard. So brotherly love is not the highest motivation for love." The second word used in the New Testament for love, as you know, is agape. Agape is the highest form of love. It is an unselfish readiness to serve others. It is not motivated by a desire for reciprocation. Although it often is reciprocated, it is not motivated by that. Agape is love with no strings attached. Agape is the love of God expressed in John 3:16, "For God so loved the world, agape the world, that he gave his only son." So as filio focuses on the natural, agape focuses on what is best for the inner man. So, okay, that's the general difference between filio and agape. And so you ask, what does all that have to do with an election discourse? One last point that Brother Steve made, I think, will clarify that. He said that love is defined by its actions. Love is defined by its actions. And then he describes the practical sides of filio and agape. He said that filio says, "I want to love the brethren by being with them." Agape says, "I want to love the brethren by being with them and by serving them." Filio says, "I want to love the brethren by sharing their blessings." Agape says, "I want to love the brethren by sharing their blessings and by helping them in time of need and bearing their burdens." Filio says, "I want to love brethren as long as they love me in return." Agape says, "I want to love the brethren regardless of anything I may get in return." And so we see that the best motivation for service really is to have a combination of filio and agape love. To love the brethren as family members, as well as to love them with a self-sacrificing love that really doesn't need to be reciprocated. I hope I'm not the only elder or deacon or sister who's ever said, "Why am I doing this? Why am I spending all these hours writing a talk or driving to a weeknight meeting or working at a convention or preparing a meal or handling a microphone or making coffee or whatever any of us do for the brethren?" There's only one right and scriptural answer to those sacrifices: love for God and love for the brethren. A love that wants to serve because serving those you love is right and good and it's godlike. And so proper motivation is the key to acceptable service. Now, if I personally examine my life and I see, you know, I really am never, ever doing anything to serve anyone, it might mean that I don't really love them, because love is defined by the service you give to others. We're all familiar with the phrase, "Have I told you lately that I love you?" And we see that that's really a good expression, because expressing our love to one another is good. And we need to say it as much as others need to hear it. But an even higher expression is, have I shown you lately that I love you? Is my service and sacrifice there to define my love for you? Now, granted, we don't always get the opportunity to serve everyone in the ecclesia. And so I'm not saying that I'm criticizing anyone personally. I have no one in mind when I thought of that except for myself. But God knows our heart. He wants to see that servant mentality in us. He wants to see a desire to demonstrate our love for him and for others. This is a foundation principle of ecclesia elections. But it's not just for elected servants. We're all to have this mentality. We're all to be servants doing whatever we can for the blessing and uplifting of one another. So the portrait of a true servant has a second element. First, we saw the importance of a willing heart to serve. And now we see that the motivation for service must be agape love if it's going to be right and acceptable. Let's see if there's other elements of a true servant. Let's turn to 2 Corinthians, the 8th chapter. Let me just tell you the background as you're looking at that. Background of this chapter is very interesting. The Apostle Paul was involved in taking up a collection for the poverty-stricken ecclesia in Jerusalem. And what makes this chapter interesting is that he's in Macedonia, and the ecclesias in Macedonia were themselves in great poverty. And so you wonder, how could the poor give to help the poor? But as it turned out, they did, and they did it in abundance. The Macedonian brethren were so concerned for the welfare of the brethren in Jerusalem that they found a way to give for their upbuilding. Let me read 2 Corinthians 8, 1 through 5 from the Phillips translation. So if you just want to listen, that might be good. It says, "Now, my brethren, we must tell you about the grace that God has given to the Macedonian churches. Somehow, in most difficult circumstances, their overflowing joy and the fact of being down to their last penny themselves produced a magnificent concern for other people. I can guarantee that they were willing to give to the limit of their means, yes, and beyond their means, without the slightest urging from me or anyone else. In fact, they simply begged us to accept their gifts and so let them share the honor of supporting their brothers in Christ. Nor was their gift, as I must confess I had expected, a mere cash payment. Instead, they made a complete dedication of themselves first to the Lord and then to us, because God willed it." My goodness, what an example. Now, there's some very important qualities we see demonstrated by the Macedonian churches that really is part of the portrait of a true servant. Now, this might not be obvious, but the first thing I notice there is the anonymity of the givers. You notice that not one specific church is mentioned. Paul simply says the churches of Macedonia did all these things. Not even one individual is mentioned here. And so I think the lesson is that a true servant of God usually prefers to remain anonymous. How different that is from the world. You know, the world, when somebody does something magnanimous, they put up a statue or they dedicate a bridge or they do something, you know, to honor that. But these brethren weren't looking for that. In fact, I think most true servants are embarrassed when they're put in the spotlight, because a true servant is just as enthusiastic when he or she serves without anyone even noticing. So remember that lesson the next time your flesh wants some recognition for something you've done, that the true servant is more content with being anonymous than being recognized. In reality, brethren, everything we do is noticed by the heavenly hosts. Paul said that we're on a stage and that we're being observed by an innumerable company of angels. But even that shouldn't matter to a servant who would prefer to remain anonymous. And just know that God is pleased. The next quality we see demonstrated by the Macedonian churches is their incredible generosity. Did you notice what Paul said about them? It says, "In their overflowing joy and the fact of being down to their last penny themselves, they produced a magnificent concern for other people." Overflowing joy at giving. That's a godlike quality. A magnificent concern for others. That, too, is what God is looking for in a servant. These brethren, as diverse as they were in all these different ecclesias, had a common vision. They were willing to give to their brethren in Jerusalem while they themselves struggled to make ends meet. But it wasn't just money that these brethren gave. Notice what it said in verse 5. Paul says, "Nor was their gift a mere cash payment. Instead, they made a complete dedication of themselves, first to the Lord and then to us, because God willed it." Well, of course, the generosity here goes well beyond financial support. Paul says that they made a complete dedication of themselves. Well, I think that can only mean one thing, that they became personally involved, that they gave their energy and care and personal compassion. They weren't just removed. They just didn't put a few pennies in a box. They got personally involved by dedicating themselves to God and to Paul and his ministry. And that type of involvement is so much more valuable than any money that they could have put for the benefit of the brethren. The next quality shown by the Macedonian brethren was one that we touched on before, is that they gave voluntarily. Paul said that they gave without the slightest urging from him or anyone else. And I love the fact that they even begged Paul to accept their gifts so that they could have the honor of supporting the brethren in Christ. And the way I picture it is that, you know, when Paul saw how generous they were being, he said, "No, hold on, brethren, you're giving too much. You better take care of yourself." And they said, "No, no, please, please take this. Let us be involved with the blessing of our brethren." What a change, what a turnaround from what you'd see anywhere else, that they were so willing to give of themselves, especially when it cost them something. That's a remarkable attitude from brethren who were down to their last penny themselves. You know, if I was that poor, I honestly can't say that I would have been there with them, unless maybe by seeing their example and the enthusiasm that they had, that maybe I could have learned from them to be that generous. My natural reaction was, you know, I need to protect myself and my family. But the Spirit has a higher level, higher message there. Giving is a greater expression of the heart when it costs something to give. It's easy to give out of your abundance. You don't even notice it when you've got a lot. And remember, that was the lesson from the widow's mite. The widow gave her mite. She gave all that she had, and that was more valuable than the rich man who threw in 10 times more than she had done, because the Lord saw that it really cost her something to give. Now, this attitude of voluntary service relates directly to the ecclesia elections. In 1 Peter 5, 2 and 3, the Apostle Peter picks up on that concept. And he tells elders to shepherd the flock of God among you, not under compulsion, but voluntarily, according to the will of God, and not for sordid gain, but with eagerness, nor yet as lording it over those allotted to your charge, but proving to be examples to the flock. And so another quality of a good shepherd, a good servant, is personal involvement. You know, personal involvement means that we don't just serve at arm's length. The best service, as we've been saying all morning, comes from the heart. And when the heart is involved, it really desires to be involved and willing to get involved. Because involvement in service and activity reveals the authenticity of our words. It's like I said earlier, have I shown you lately that I love you? I want to show you and not just tell you. And so, brethren, we need Macedonian elders. We need elders who, by their example and unselfishness, serve willingly and with an overflowing joy. And we need to be a Macedonian ecclesia, copying the spirit demonstrated by those brethren so long ago. Here we are almost 2,000 years later, and we're marveling at their service to others because we realize that good examples never die. The best elders are the best servants. And the best way to lead is by example. So one question we should ask when considering a brother for eldership is, does he lead by example, or is he all words? Is he willing to get his hands dirty in the service of others? Does he reach out to people in trying to help them? Does he have the spirit of generosity, both with his means and his talents? These elements are important qualities to look for in leadership. And these really are at the foundation of the qualifications for eldership given in 1 Timothy. Let's turn to that. It's a required set of scriptures to discuss when we're talking about the elections. Let me read it again from Phillips. This is 1 Timothy 3, verses 2 to 7. It says, "For the office of bishop, or overseer, or elder, a man must be of blameless reputation. He must be married to one wife only, and be a man of self-control and discretion. He must be a man of disciplined life. He must be hospitable and have the gift of teaching. He must be neither intemperate nor violent, but gentle. He must not be a controversialist, nor must he be greedy for money. He must have the proper authority in his own household and be able to control and command the respect of his children. If a man cannot rule in his own house, how can he look after the church of God? He must not be a beginner in the faith for fear of his becoming conceited and sharing the devil's downfall. He should, in addition to the above qualifications, have a good reputation with the outside world in case his good name is attacked and he is caught by the devil that way." Now, I'm not going to treat each of these qualifications individually, as we've done it countless times over the years. I will say that we should each look at these qualifications in the context of our own servanthood. These are qualities that all the church members should have. Is it just the elders that should be hospitable? Is it okay for non-elders to be controversialists or greedy for money? No, of course not. All Paul is saying is that we make sure that we elect only brethren who definitely have these qualities. But they are no less important in any of the Lord's people. Now, even the idea of being able to teach, I think, is something that we should all strive for. We should all endeavor to be able to explain the truth in a clear and concise way, because if we can, it shows that we really understand what we believe. And then Paul goes on and lists the qualification for deacons, in much the same way as for elders. This is 1 Timothy 3, 8 through 13. He says, "Deacons similarly should be men of serious outlook and sincere conviction. They too should be temperate and not sordidly greedy for profit. They should hold the mystery of the faith with complete sincerity. Let them serve a period of probation first, and only serve as deacons if they prove satisfactory. Their wives should share their serious outlook and must be women of discretion and self-control, women who can be thoroughly trusted. Deacons should be men with only one wife, able to control their children and manage their own households properly. Those who do well as deacons earn for themselves a proper standing, as well as the ability to speak freely on matters of the Christian faith." Quite an interesting list. Serious about their consecrations, sincere in their convictions, not greedy, self-controlled. And then Paul speaks of the wives of deacons. He says that they should be trustworthy. Now, that's an interesting one, that last one. And it's such an important quality for a true servant of God to possess. From elders to deacons to sisters to brothers, trustworthiness. We should be trustworthy, not only with financial matters, that's probably one of the least important things, but also in the emotional struggles that the brethren have. You know, if you're a trustworthy person, brethren will feel free to come to you with a struggle they may be having or with a particular problem. And so imagine a servant who wasn't trustworthy. Why would the master give them any special duties or allow them to handle anything important? And you think, what is more important than the heart development of our brethren? So we should be trustworthy with their emotions and their feelings and their struggles, and know that they can come to us without feeling, oh, if I tell Brother X my problems, he's going to think less of me. The brethren should know that that should never be the case, but we're all walking the same way, and we need to compare notes with one another and help one another. We need to be trustworthy. So how do we summarize the portrait of a faithful and true servant? Brethren, it's really the art of unselfish living. It's an art that's practiced by few and mastered by even fewer. It's difficult to have a servant's heart in a world that is dominated by selfish pursuits. But God's plan is not designed for man to live selfishly or treat others in a cold, uncaring manner. Remember what Jesus said in Matthew 11, 28 and 29. He said, "Come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you shall find rest for your souls." The yoke that Jesus asks each of us to carry I believe, would be overwhelming for us if we resented having to carry it. Our service to others would be a great burden if we really didn't want to do it. But when we accept those things, the yokes that the Lord puts on us, the service of others, is a great honor and privilege, like those Macedonian brethren did. It changes everything. It completely revolutionizes our attitude of service and sacrifice. It makes it so positive and so good, knowing it's the lifestyle that God wants us to live. And when we take a step back and look at the portrait of a servant that the Scriptures draw for us, we see that it is a wonderful and gratifying lifestyle. So we've seen first the importance of a willing heart. We see the need to have a servant's mentality. The motivation for our service must be love, even if our service is not reciprocated. The true servant of God revels in anonymity. He doesn't need praise or credit for his service. A true servant is generous, almost to a fault, and becomes personally involved. And he doesn't keep others at arm's length. He doesn't pretend to be perfect and not have to be examined by others. There's genuine humility in the heart of a true servant, and he treats others with a gentle touch. Patience is needed in a true servant, as well as personal self-control. A true servant is serious about his or her consecration and sincere about their convictions. And it goes almost without saying that a true servant of God must be trustworthy. Have I touched on every quality of a true servant? Oh no, there's so many more. Do I have all these qualities myself? Oh my goodness, absolutely not. But brethren, I sure want to have them. And that's one place to start. I'd like to close by reading a true story that I came across later, because I think it illustrates something important about our service. It goes like this. It says, there was a young boy by the name of John Todd. He was born in Rutland, Vermont in the autumn of 1800. Shortly after his birth, the Todd family moved to the small village of Killingsworth, Vermont. It was there, when John was only six, that both parents died. All the children had to be parceled out among relatives, and a kind-hearted aunt who lived 10 miles away agreed to take John, to love him, to care for him, and to give him a home. The boy lived there for some 15 years and finally left as he went on to study for the ministry. Time passed gently as he began and later excelled in his work as a pastor. While he was in middle life, his elderly aunt fell desperately ill. Realizing death was not far off, in great distress, she wrote to her nephew. The pitiful letter included some of the same questions all of us might one day ask. What will death be like? Will it mean the end of everything? Moved with compassion and swamped with the memories of yesteryear, he wrote her these words of assurance. He wrote, "It is now 35 years since I, a little boy of six, was left quite alone in the world. You sent me word you would give me a home and be a kind mother to me. I have never forgotten the day when I made the long journey of 10 miles to your house in North Killingsworth. I can still recall my disappointment when, instead of coming for me yourself, you send your hired man, Caesar, to fetch me. I well remember my tears and my anxiety as, perched high on your horse and clinging tight to Caesar, I rode off to my new home. Night fell before we finished the journey, and as it grew dark, I became lonely and afraid. 'Do you think she'll go to bed before I get there?' I asked Caesar anxiously. 'Oh, no,' he said reassuredly. 'She'll sure stay up for you. When we get out of these here woods, you'll see her candle shining in the window.' Presently, we did ride out in the clearing, and there, sure enough, was your candle. I remember you were waiting at the door, and you put your arms close about me, and that you lifted me, a tired and bewildered little boy, down from the horse. You had a big fire burning on the hearth, a hot supper waiting for me on the stove. After supper, you took me to my new room. You heard me say my prayers, and then you sat beside me until I fell asleep. You probably realize why I'm recalling all this to your memory. Someday soon, God will send for you and take you to your new home. Don't fear the summons, the strange journey, or the messenger of death. God can be trusted to do as much for you as you were kind enough to do for me so many years ago. At the end of the road, you will find love and a welcome waiting for you, and you will be safe in God's care. I shall watch you and pray for you until you are out of sight, and then wait for the day when I shall make the journey myself and find you waiting at the end of the road to greet me." What an incredible way to comfort his aunt with the promises of future blessings for the good service she did. And of course, the lesson for us is mentioned in Hebrews 6:10. It says, "God is not unrighteous to forget your labor and work of love, which you have showed towards his name, and that ye have ministered to the saints and do minister." And likewise, the words of Jesus, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant. Enter thou into the joys of thy Lord." Brethren, may we all see clearly the portrait of a servant as painted for us by the Scriptures. May we see the excellency of living that type of lifestyle. And may we each commit to doing the work involved in having a servant's mentality. And in our elections next week, may we select faithful examples that demonstrate the spirit of joyful service.